My name is Bob McAteer, and I'm an alcoholic. A lady once at one of the conferences I attended, when she came up to the microphone, she said her name, and she says, "I'm so-and-so, and I'm a real alcoholic." And that's the way I like to think of myself. That's what it says in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, if you are a real alcoholic, or if you are seriously alcoholic, and I fit that description. What Dave was talking about is something that I learned a long time about alcoholics in the program. It says we may be crazy, but we're not stupid. So I guess that's the reason I didn't quit fighting that door. I want to thank the committee for inviting me here. 25th anniversaries are something special. I think they're milestones in our lives. We think of 25th wedding anniversaries and other types of events at work and even in AA. And this conference, the fact that it's continued for 25 years is something to say in itself, and I really do appreciate being here. This morning I couldn't help notice, we always think about God and our lives and our actions, and do miracles really happen? Is God active in our lives? And I looked at that choir this morning, and what I saw up here was a stage full of people that you know that have had pain and despair in their lives. There's no member of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon who has not experienced real pain. And to hear these people sing and give glory to God is really wonderful, a miracle in itself. And I really do. I appreciate it, and it really did touch me. One of the things that I wanted to mention is when I got here, we all got the cups. And there is an inscription on the cup, and it says on page 29, yes, I am one of them too, and I must have this thing. And I didn't recall the phrase. So I borrowed a big book yesterday to look it up. And I'd like to tell you what it says about that on page 25. It says each individual in the personal stories describe in his own language and from his point of view the way he established a relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholics, men and women, desperately in need, will see in these pages and believe that that it is only by the fully disclosing of ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one too, and I must have this thing. And I think that was graphically demonstrated by our opening speaker, Marie. She fully disclosed the parts of her life that were very, very painful and how she had changed. And Karen talked about the insanity of living with alcoholism in the home. And I think every one of us experienced that at some times. And George, the search for God. Someone once told me that, it says in the book, it says that our illness is one that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And someone gave me once the definition of the difference between a spiritual experience and an emotional experience. Many of us can have meetings like this as today, and where we heard the choir, and they were very emotional. They touched our hearts, and many people did cry in this room. But they are not long-lasting. When you have a spiritual experience, and when you encounter God, and in this spiritual experience, it will change your life forever. And that's some of the things I want to hope to share with you today. Some of the places that I've had spiritual experiences in my life. There is a story about a man who died, and he went to heaven, and it came to a place very much like this. It was a very beautiful place that had lots of trees and mountains, and it was very colorful. And St. Peter led him into this place, and he went down to one little alcove, it must have been like a campground, and they could see these people over in there, and he says, well, he says, there's Presbyterians in there. And they went someplace else, and they went along a little way, and he says, now there's Mormons in there. And then they found the Catholics and the Baptists, and they kept going on. And the guy says, you mean to tell me, he says, you have heaven divided up among all these denominations? He says, yeah, he says, they seem to get along better that way. He says they're quite happy. And he says, well, he says, I was walking down there by the lake, and he says, I saw this island out there, and there were people laughing and having just a good time. And they're all carrying tape recorders and styrofoam cups. He says, who were they? He says, oh, St. Peter said, don't pay any attention to them. He says, they're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're only up here one day at a time. Now, that may describe our daily reprieve. I don't know. And this may be as spiritual as this talk's ever going to get. The song last night recalled something. Well, I'll touch on that a little bit. Well, I think most of us, myself anyway, and I think most people, never start out in life thinking, when I grow up, I want to be an alcoholic or I want to be a drug addict. And I wasn't any different. And I saw what alcoholism could do in a family, and I really promised myself I would never be that way. So when I was young, I didn't drink very much. And it wasn't until after I got in the Army and was married that I came to St. Albans, West Virginia, where I live now. Joan and I met there. I want to introduce Joan to you. See, we don't... many of you might remember her. She talked here the year before last at Bluestone. And stand up, Joan. We don't try and tell our stories. But at least if I'm talking about this lady, you ought to at least know who she is. I want you to know we've been happily married 29 years. That's not bad out of 37. Well, yeah, Jim and I got married, and we came to St. Albans, and we didn't know anybody, and she had a brother that there, and at that time there was no liquor by the drink. This was in 1955, and her brother introduced us to many of his friends in St. Albans, and the way most people did then is they go to house party and it was bring your own bottle. And I soon found out that I didn't have to worry about being an alcoholic anymore, because I could outdrink most of these people. When they were getting sloppy drunk, I was still going pretty strong, and I was married, and I didn't think that with the responsibilities, I guess, I needed to be much concerned about this anymore. But it wasn't very long before Saturdays didn't come along soon enough. I'd start getting a pint on Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, and it wasn't very long before I became a daily drinker. And I've had a lot of experiences and a lot of degradation that should have told me something about my drinking that I think, like most of us, we never listen to. One of them, and I recounted last night when they were singing that song, is that I don't come back here anymore. It was kind of like a revelation, almost a flashback. The place that I really came in touch with my morning drink was here at Bluestone. And it was probably at the end of this road down here. Joan and I and another couple used to come up here and go camping, go fishing. And most of my drink of choice was bourbon, and I chased it with beer, and didn't drink much of any other types of things at that time. And we were camping down here fishing, and been here all weekend, Friday and Saturday, and Sunday I'd run out of bourbon. And I can remember the fellow that I was with, his name was Jim. He had a ice chest, and he had a fifth of gin in it. And I was sick and shaky, and I took a drink of that cold gin, and it worked. And all at once I found something that helped me. And that's probably one of the binges that I went on, first binges that I ever went on, was right here at Bluestone. I'm not one of those people who wonder why I'm an alcoholic. I drank for the effects and the taste of it. Alcohol did everything for me. If I was hot, I could drink a drink and cool off. If I was cold, I could take a drink and warm up. If I was going too fast, I could take a drink and slow down. And if I was really tired, I could take a drink and it picked me up. What I found about alcohol for me, it did everything for me. And you know, the people who tell you that they drink for taste and not effect, invite somebody to go fishing with you some weekend and say, let's take a couple of cases of water and go fishing. It doesn't seem to work that way. I think of the degradation and that we've experienced at the place that I worked. I was getting, we had to punch a time clock. And one morning I went in and I couldn't get the card into the slot. My hand shook so much and I dropped it on the floor and I got out of line. And, you know, when booze is beginning to do these things to you, you know something's wrong. One morning I woke up and the fireman had broken into our house. We had a neighbor who just died this past summer. His name was Jim Cunningham, a non-alcoholic. He saw smoke billowing out of our kitchen window and he called the fire department. And they came in and they literally broke into our house and they carried me and Joan out of bed. And I remember them laying me on the couch in the living room saying something about the poor fellow's been asphyxiated. And the truth of the matter was I was still drunk. But the things I like to talk to you about is how what I think is typical of alcoholic thinking and what is and the way that I perceive things sober. After that event, there were several things that were in my mind. I was wondering if it was going to be in the papers. I always put fires in the newspapers. I wondered if my boss was going to find out. The way I looked at that particular thing, it was going to cost us $50 or so to buy a new mattress. And all that did was cut into my drinking money. That looked like that was 5/5 of whiskey, no matter how you cut it. Most important of all, it was Joan's fault. It was her side of the bed to burn. She'd be more careful with her cigarettes. Been all right. What I've come to realize since I've been sober, because of my drinking, I almost snuffed out the lives of myself, my wife, and my entire family. But that's typical of alcoholic thinking. It's when your life is so bizarre and it seems so natural. It seems like such a good thing to do at the time. Along in the summer of 1964, Joan was pregnant, and she had trouble. She been in the hospital one or two times, and one night she lost this baby at home. And I bundled her up in the car, and I took her to the hospital. Now, she had been... I think what I'm trying to say here is that many times people don't think alcoholics care. And I really did care. And she was in that emergency room, and I was trying to make sure that she had gotten the best care. I was just trying to see that she got the attention she needed. And in truth, I was making an ass out of myself. And I went home. Now, our lives had dwindled down to where there was just one other couple and ourselves. I worked as a salesman then, and I had a lot of acquaintances. I met a lot of people in the daytime. But the truth of the matter is that at night, in the evening, there was just Joan and myself and another couple. Their name was Mary Lou and Walter. They were neighbors of ours originally. They were up the street, just one or two houses up. And if you drank like I did, it's hard to find people to drink like you do. You have to find people you can drink with that you're comfortable with. And Mary Lou and Walter fit that place. And the way it was is that we were either up their house drinking or they were down at ours. So I called Mary Lou and Walter and they came down to watch our boys while I'd taken Joan to the hospital. And when I got home, I went to their house and told them the events that had happened. And Walter had a pint there and I had a few more drinks. And I started home to where I lived. It was a distance of not more than maybe 8 or 10 blocks. And down in front of St. Albans High School, they blew me down, Caudal Terrace. And I remember pleading with that cop, don't lock me up. My wife's in the hospital, I have two kids at home, don't arrest me. And it didn't make any difference, they threw me in jail. And the next morning, Walter came down and, He had a property bond and he got me out. I'll digress a little bit because this is kind of funny. It kind of relates to Marie's talk the other night. Several years before I came into AA, Joan and I had been to a Christmas party. And on the way home from the party, we had an argument. Or at least I think that's what happened. And she had one of these little bags women carry, you know, and she swatted at me. And about that time, I zigged or zagged, and these blue lights were behind me and blew me down. So they take me to South Charleston Jail, and they're taking my tie, and they're taking my shoelaces, and they're taking my belt. And Joan says, "You can't do that to him." So they locked her up too. Now, I have another definition of being what Dave was talking about, being the difference between crazy and stupid. When I was there, I had driven where you had to hold one eye, a hand over one eye, so you could just see one line, you know. Some of you may have experienced that. And I wasn't there yet. I know what it's like to drink and drive, you know. I was sober, or I thought. So I demanded a blood test. So they took me to the hospital, and they gave it to me. And then they used it in evidence against me. Well, yeah, they let me out of jail that morning, and because Walter had gotten the property, that's what stirred that thought. Walter had gotten the property bond originally to get me out of jail the first time. And I was bitter. I thought that one thing these policemen did, they not only arrested me, they towed my car in. Now, they could have left it down where it was, you know, on Kanawha Terrace, but I had to pay the towing bill. And I went home, and I had still had some booze left in the house, and I had a few more drinks. And I don't remember anything. I had a blackout. Had lots of blackouts. My life had gotten to the place where, you know, you could wait all week to see a certain TV program. I was a home drinker. Take a couple of belts and be watching that program and never remember how it ended. You know, that was the way that it was. But what was important in this case is that I didn't even go see Joan in the hospital. And the next day I went up and I saw her and she was bitter. She was very mad. She felt at least one time in my life I could have done better. That here she has just lost a baby, she's in the hospital, and I didn't even come to see her. The following morning she called about 7 o'clock in the morning. And she said they were going to release her at 9. Come and get her. Well, I'm someone who's needed a morning drink now for about 3 years or more. And I had a drink and it didn't help. Had another one and it didn't help. And finally, about near 9 o'clock, I realized I was drunk and I didn't want to go up there and embarrass her or myself, either one. And I called my friend Mary Lou and Walter, and they went and got her out of the hospital and brought her home. Well, she was pretty aggravated, and we live on a hill, and I had, somebody once described an alcoholic car. It's one that's dented all the way around. Well, that's what I was driving. I was driving an alcoholic car, and gas was a lot less expensive than it is today, but the way I was really living a day at a time before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't know it. The way that I really operated was that if I could wind up with any given day with $3.57, I was all right. Now, why this was important, I needed a dollar for gas to go to work on. And I drank Barclays, which was $2.57 a pint. And if I could wind up with any given day with enough gas and enough to drink on, I was all right. So these guys would come up in attendance. That's before I had all these self-service things, you know. They'd come up and they'd say, "Well, you want me to check your oil?" And I'd say no, because I wasn't going to buy any anyway, you know. So I didn't put very much oil in my car. And as we drove up on this hill, the red oil light began to flash on the dash of the car. And I swore under my breath and told her to get up there and took Joan home. And I left. And I went down to the bottom of the hill and I put some oil in the car. I went over to the Nitro to the liquor store and got some bourbon and I drove back. But before I put the oil in the car, the engine had developed this little rattle in it. And before I got up to where I live, about a block and a half where I live, the engine just froze up and locked. And the last thing that I remember is walking down my street with a brown sack of whiskey under my arm. I don't remember anything from that moment on. I don't remember going into the house. I don't remember talking to Joan. I don't remember any of the events. And it's one of those strange things. I've never even asked her what happened. I don't really want to know. Just don't really want to know. And I woke up at a time where it was just gray out. I don't know if there was dusk or dawn. It was just gray out. And I thought, my God, what have I done? All the things that I thought I was never capable of doing, I did in that one weekend. And I remember what I said. I said, I can't go on this way. I realize now that that was the first honest prayer that I had uttered in a long, long time. I'd gone to church many, many, many Sundays, primarily to keep Joan off my back, to set an example for the kids. And all the time I'm in there, it's just a din. How soon am I going to get out of here to have a drink? But I heard someone say one time that in the Bible, when they talk about Job, they said Job shook his fist at God. And that was it was a very earnest, honest prayer. And I think that's what happened in this particular instance in my life. It is when you're calling out to God from the depths within you. I said, I just can't go on. And I had a fleeting thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, call AA. I didn't know anybody in AA. Some years before, Joan went to the local priest to blow the whistle on me. She says, went down and said, Bob's drinking too much. And he gave her the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told her to come home and suggested I read it. Well, I told her what she could do with that book. So Joan sat in our house reading the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, with a mixed drink in her hand, and she said, they're telling stories about people like you. So I really didn't have maybe I've heard a few jokes about AA or something, but I really didn't know anything about them. But that was what I said. I want to talk to someone from AA. And I went back to, I passed out. I went back to sleep. The next morning, Joan said, do you still remember wanting to talk to someone from AA? And I said, I did. She says, well, in a little while, there's going to be a man up here to see you. And he came up, and he was an old fella, and I was 33, and he was in his 60s. And I remember a couple of things he said. He said, have you had anything to drink today? And I said, well, I just finished off about that much I had in a pint before you got here. He says, that's okay. He says, that's just for medicinal purposes. And all at once I knew I had a friend, someone who was not going to chastise me about my drinking. And he told me, I guess, a little bit about what his life was like and what happened, what it was like now. And he took me over to a place that was a dry and out hospital in St. Albans called Goff's Rest Home. And he and another man had a conversation about me that I was not part of. That's the way I can describe it. And he took me, a little while later, he took me home and he gave me some pamphlets about AA. And he talked about the 12 steps, I guess, and I remember the thing he told me when he dropped me off of my house. He says, Bob, he says, you're a sick man. He said, I had about this much of a beard, and he said, get shaved. He says, get cleaned up. He says, it'll make you feel better. He said, get something to eat, even if you don't want to. He said, drink lots of fluids, but nothing with alcohol in it. And he says, I'll be back tonight and take you to a meeting. And he did. And I remember how terrified I was. When I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only way I mentally can describe it to anybody is that it was like these old grade B movies where they show death row. You know, it's this long hall with the cross with the door down at the end of it. And that's kind of the way I felt when I was approaching that meeting. And at the time, I thought it's because I didn't know what I was getting into. In retrospect, I think it's a little bit different. I think it's the first time in my life that I ever approached the idea of not drinking entirely. That's a scary thought for an alcoholic. Up until then, it was another pint to get well on. Or I just won't drink any more bourbon, I'll just drink beer. Even started drinking stuff like cherry liquor and peach brandy, anything that would, you know, looking for another way to try and find a way to drink successfully. But this time I was really serious. I knew that I couldn't go on, and yet I didn't think there was any hope. I thought that if one time Joan tried to take her life, and she went to a psychiatrist. When she came, I waited for her outside, and when she came out, she says, "This man won't take my case unless I stop drinking." And because of the seriousness of the nature of what happened, I really made an honest effort not to drink. But it was like something being imposed on you. It's like going to jail. And for every waking hour, for those weeks and months that I didn't drink, it was hell. I always had it on my mind. I was miserable. And I couldn't see in sobriety being any different. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's kind of what I thought, that even if I could find a way to be sober, I could never be happy again. And each one of the people in that room that night, they went around and they told me a little bit about what their life was like, what's happened, and what it was like now. One man said something to this fact. He said, "Bob," he said, "try and get through the rest of the night without a drink." He says, "We only stop drinking one day at a time." He says, "Try and get through the rest of the night." He says, "You can be the first one at the liquor store in the morning if you want to." I've heard people come into AA and they kind of flippantly say to a new person, "Try it for 60 days, 90 days. You can always cash it in and go back and start your drinking over again." Hell, I wasn't worried about 90 days. How can I get through the rest of the night, the next 8 hours, without a drink? Next night I went to a meeting somewhere else and I heard somebody else that said something that let me hang on to another day. They told me alcoholism was an illness and that it was going to require a 180-degree change in my life. And that I could do this possibly if I tried to do these 12 steps as best as I was capable of. They didn't say you had to do it perfectly, but any particular time in your life, you have to give it that best effort that you can. They said that every minute that you're staying away from a drink, you're getting better. And that's good news. First time in my life, I might be getting better. So, when we left that meeting that night, Al came back and he dropped me off at my house. And outside, he began to tell me how he stayed sober. He said when he got up in the morning, he remembered that he was an alcoholic and that he asked help from a higher power that he called God to get him through that day without a drink. And he said, "If I am fortunate enough to get through that day without a drink," he says, "I will thank the God of my understanding that I have been granted a day's sobriety." And he said, I went in that night, I followed his direction. He said, "Pray tonight, ask for help." He says, "Even if you don't believe," he says, "be sincere when you ask." So I did, that's what I did that first night. I went in and I prayed, "If there is such a thing as a God, the least you can do is get me through this night without a drink." And I made it. I find it very difficult in some, what you might say, expressions you hear in AA. In the chapter to the agnostic, it refers to God as a intelligent creator of the universe. And they will refer to it frequently as this intelligent creator. And sometimes I think that I know what people are saying. They're saying to a new person, try and hang on to something. Something's better than nothing. But they will say, use a radiator as your God, or a doorknob as your God. I find nothing intelligent in a doorknob or a radiator. And even more, I think it does a disservice not only to God, but it does a disservice to the new person. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the ability to find this power greater than yourself, what you consider this intelligent creator, whatever you may call him or however you may perceive him, is the cornerstone that you build recovery on. I can't swim. I always use this analogy because of that. I'm so helpless out in the water. If I were drowning, I sure don't want anybody to throw me a radiator. It's as simple as that. You know, I don't know how else to express it. I'm, if you're drowning, you're going to look for something to hang on to. And I think that's important. Al, in that particular phrase of his, was also important to me in another way. When I first came in today, they wouldn't tell you how long they were sober. And new people kind of watch new people anyway, and you'd say, how long's that guy been sober? You know, pointing to him, you know. Oh, he's been sober 90 days, and I thought he could walk on water, you know. And I would say to, I'd say to Al, how long have you been sober? And he'd say, just today, damn it, and he'd walk away. And that went over for a period of time, and finally I nailed him down. I don't know these numbers are right, but he said, I've been sober 8,432 days, one day at a time, something like that. Well, I'm still rum-dum. I go home and get my pencil and paper along to visit, you know. Yeah, I figured it out. Al's been sober 23 years, and I was 33 years old. Man, I had not had a drink almost as long as I had been alive. And yet he still found it that he was grateful he was experiencing a day's sobriety. I never forgot that. Anyhow, I started going to other meetings, and I always found something that would help me in order to just hang on a little bit more. One of the first turning points that I think I had in AA was after about 2 weeks, I said to Al, I said, you know, I said, generally I can't be gone to all these damn meetings. He said, why not? I said, well, we've got a babysitter to get, and we have this and happening and this in our lives. And he said, well, he said, did you ever let anything like that keep you from going to the liquor store? And that was my first moment of truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never let anything keep me from going to the liquor store. And I realized that if I were going to try and stay sober, I was going to try and at least have to put that effort into doing whatever I could in this program. Then the other one, the funny one was, I said to him one day, not probably in the same time frame, I said, well, what are we going to do about Walter? He says, who's Walter? That's my drinking buddy. He needs this as bad as I do. He says, well, Bob, he says, best thing you can do, he says, try and stay sober yourself. And he says, if Walter sees anything in you, he might want to have, he says, maybe he will find this program too. He said, remember, he says, if you take credit for the ones you get, you have to take credit for the ones that get away. And that seemed like such a strange statement at the time. But over a period of years, I know the truth to that. And Al was good for me. George was talking about last night. George sat in a meeting with another friend of mine. He's dead now. His name was Big Herb. And Big Herb was talking in, as we went around the circle, and he said he had the meanest sponsor, meanest SOB for a sponsor that ever drew breath. And they went around the room, and they came to me, and I said, I had this sponsor who was a kindly old gentleman. And George says, for a long time, he didn't know we were both talking about the same man. There's lots of things that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I want to share with you are both what might be considered, some might be mountaintop experiences, and some of them may be the valleys of living. And the thing that's important in these events is the encounters that I've had with God. One of the mountaintop experiences that some of us have been experienced in AA is first of all, is sobriety. Waking up sober. Being able to see the beauty in the things around us that we've never seen for a long time. I find great, even today, I find my gratitude for sobriety can be represented in small things. My hand doesn't tremble anymore. I can remember walking into a restaurant and couldn't pick up the cup out of the saucer because it would rattle. I can eat old runny eggs in the morning if I want to. Don't always want to. When I walk out of the house and sunlight doesn't hurt my eyes. Now, for people who have not experienced that, they don't know. They just don't know. I've had a wonderful experiences in service. People who do not get involved in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, are denying themselves of real pleasures as plus growth in the program. When George was talking last night, He was state chairman and I was delegate in 1971. And those particular years were very rewarding for me. To be able to attend the national conference is a mountaintop experience for anyone who's ever experienced it. Things weren't going well for me in AA. One of the things that happened to me soon after I came into the program, I thought my boss was going to call me in one morning and tell me what a good job I was doing because I could do things before 10 o'clock, you know, and the buzz was out of my ears and I was performing so much better that he was going to give me a raise. And he called me in one morning and he said that things were bad and that business was such that they couldn't afford me anymore and they laid me off. So that year, on October, November, and December, I didn't work. Came into Alcoholics Anonymous on September 15th, 1964. That's our sobriety day. And those were hard months. We were going to meetings, and there seemed to be a lot of contradictions that were happening in our lives. We owed three house payments on our house, and they said, if you don't come up with these three payments, we're going to foreclose on your house. And people would say, don't worry, Bob, just hang in there. If you stay sober, it's going to work out. And I lost my job. Worked getting a little bit of unemployment. Joan had a few days that she worked odds and ends, and we just kind of greased by. One of the most memorable times in my experience of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think in my view is then and still is a mountaintop experience, was our first Christmas in AA. We were broke. There was a lady in the group who came to Joan and she said, I normally give some extra money, I tithe and I give some extra money to our church, but she says, I thought I just want to give you this, and she gave Joan $20. And with that, we bought our two kids Christmas presents and we shared dollar gifts. And I can honestly tell you, that was the best Christmas we've ever had then or since because we were sober. And so, but shortly after that, in January, February, I got a job with a sales job with a very reputable company and was doing well for many, many years. In fact, I did so well that I decided that I wanted to go in business for myself. In going into business for yourself, there's a lot of risk, and I often think don't always know what motivated, but I think there's one thing, and it's finally the life of this alcoholic anyhow, is I have an inner clock in me that ticks all the time. Still there, it's why I come to meetings and why I still try and use the steps. As this clock says to me, nobody tells me what to do. Nobody. Now, if you don't want to have a boss, what's the best way to do it? Go into business for yourself. I think that may have been one of the driving ambitions. So an AA friend and another partner and I went into business, and things seemed to be going pretty well. Shortly after that, a few years after that, about the same time we went in business, I guess. Joan was 43 years old, and she called me up one morning, and she says, Doc Soulsby says he thinks I'm pregnant. And I said, don't you worry about it. I said, Doc Soulsby's probably taking too much of his own medicine and he'll be all right. Well, Michael came along. When this young baby came into our lives, we struggled with, maybe Joan more so than me, how do you cope with a young child at our age? But one of the things that I thought that this child was going to do for me was eliminate one of the regrets that I had. I'm not talking about a remorse or a disappointment, a regret. One of the things that I was not able to experience because of my drinking was remembering my other two boys growing up. Kevin was 6 years old when we came in the program. Joan tells me eight. She does better math than I. And Sean was 2 years younger. And I don't remember a lot about that time. Like a lot of families can remember when their kids first went to school, their first communion, playing on the Little League,
There's a lot of things like that. When those kids experienced that, I was always drunk and never around. So in those particular years, I was deprived because of my drinking of knowing how these little kids grew up. So when Michael came along, I thought, well, now this is God's gift to me. I'll be able to maybe relive some of those experiences through him. But we come to conclusions that after that, there may have been other reasons for God putting him in our life. Well, Michael was 2 years old and was 1977. Along about that time, our youngest middle son at that time, there's 14 years difference between Sean and Michael, entered into high school, junior high school and high school. And he began to fool with drugs, beer. First episode, I guess, in his life, we got a call and we had to go up to City Park because a 16-year-old boy was passed out up in the park, and we had to go up and find him and get him there. We brought him home. And I'm going to say some things now, or it's just conjecture on my part. I really don't know. But I think possibly Sean found out that when he drank, he couldn't handle it very well. When I came in, they gave me a different definition of alcoholism than I ever heard on the outside. It says, if alcohol is interfering with the way you want to live, then you have a drinking problem. And I think maybe that's what Sean was experiencing. It was a little bit of that he couldn't handle that booze. So he started fooling with marijuana. And I don't know how much longer, at least we only know about a couple of episodes that he ever gotten anything any stronger than that. Long years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, Art Linkletter came to Charleston. He talked at a town hall, and he talked about, it's back in 1960 or thereabouts, about how his daughter, he spent 30 minutes talking about his 50 People Are Funny show, and the other 30 minutes he spent talking about his daughter who got involved in LSD. And at that time, I could never have perceived anything like that would ever happen in my family. Ever. Well, what happened with Sean is that he did get involved with something, one of the hallucinogens, and we had one bad experience with him at home that I'm aware of. And in July of 1977, I was at an Al-Anon conference. I was taping the event. And I got a call up there that there had been problems at home and that Sean had gotten drunk and gotten picked up by the police. He came home and Joan was there with him alone. And I don't want to recount all the things that happened there because I wasn't there, but I can tell you this. That because of the beer and the marijuana and the hallucinogens, my son shot himself in our home. It's a terrible, terrible event in the life of any family. I think that when you lose a child, it's different than any other person around you. Because no one perceives that they will ever outlive their children. Ever. And it was such a waste. He was such a fine boy. Had such admirable quality. And we're Catholics, and he died on a Friday night, and the funeral is not until... we don't have funerals on Sunday. The funeral wasn't until Monday. And that was a very, very long time from Friday till Monday. The pain is like a pressure. It's like something unrelenting. It never stops. Even when you're trying to sleep, you can feel what's happening. It's like just in a constant dose, never getting any rest. And when Monday came along, we had the funeral. And some of you who are not Catholic may not understand the way the services run. But after communion, the priest goes up and he sits down at the behind the altar, and it's kind of a time of meditation. We had a niece named Mary Margaret, and Joan and I were not had no idea that this was going to happen. We had no plans for it. It was just kind of spontaneous between this girl and her mother, I guess. But she came up and she stood at the head of our son's casket and she played a flute. And the melody of the song was a black hymn called Kumbaya. Come by, Lord. Come by here, Lord. Come by here. And while that moment transpired, I can honestly say that whatever that pain and that I experienced was literally melted and just lifted away. It doesn't mean even at moments like this that I don't have reminiscing. You know, it doesn't mean that there are not times of emotion about this boy, but the pain is no longer there. I went out to the funeral car and I said to Joan, well, I told her what I experienced at that moment in the church. And she said she experienced the very same thing. This is a place where I, in my own life, I could feel the presence of God in such a real sense that I've never known before. The idea of this happening to two people simultaneously is beyond coincidence. I've heard somebody in AA, and I think it's the best description I've ever heard. It says that coincidence is when God does something anonymously. And because of this, I think that it's necessary for me to share these type of things with people in our home group. It's odd. We've had three people in our home group who have lost children since they've been sober. One man, his daughter was living out in Arizona and went to a dentist. She was 23 years old. Her youngest child, 6 months old, and took sleeping gas to have a tooth extracted and died in the chair. But it shocked many families. The other lady is another lady in our group whose son went to a football event in Pittsburgh and died while he was there. The important thing of it is that regardless of the events in your life, if you practice the program, God will be with you and it will not be necessary to drink. That's the point I'm really trying to make. Is that the God of my understanding, it is a journey. Life is a journey away from God and back to God. That's my perception of life. And along this journey, I've had encounters with God. And my first one was with AA. Maybe my second one was in this time with the death of Sean. A few months after that, our business took a turn for the worse. It was about the time the coal strike hit in West Virginia, and many of the customers, although we weren't doing work for coal mines, many of the people we did business did work for the coal mines, and our business just dried up. And along in, we recognized that, we struggled. We tried hard, the partners and myself, to keep this thing going. For the last 18 months that we stayed in business, I only drew a salary 6 months out of those 18 months, and they were not consecutive. And Joan describes it this way. She says that paper towels were a luxury around our house. And it was a hard, hard time. We used up all our savings. Finally, we got to the place that we had to file bankruptcy in this business. What I want to share with you basically is that I have had more than one bottom since I've come into Alcoholics Anonymous. The bottoms I've hit are not just that first one that you come just because I found out that I was powerless over alcohol. And this was a very, very hard time for me because one of the most painful things that I've ever experienced was watch those people auction off the thing that I had worked so hard for and was a lifelong ambition to have my own business. And to realize that now, after all this was said and done, I was back right where I started from, like when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was broke. We had no more money. I was 47 years old, and I had to go out in the job market again and start a new profession all over again. The only thing that I had to grasp onto and to hold onto was the positive realization that regardless of what would happen, if I stayed sober, and we aren't. That's the promise they gave me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's never changed. It's never changed. I have no way of knowing where the events of my life will take me as long as I stay sober. But I sure know where they'll go if I pick up a drink. There's nothing left but we'll wind up into either a jail, a mental institution, or a grave. And I used to pay lip service to that phrase. I parrot that in AA meetings. And I was sober along about 10 years, and I was thinking one day, and when they'd say something like that, I'd say, you know, Walter's not dead. Walter's not in jail. I wouldn't say it out loud. I'd say it mentally. And one day, Walter died. Walter died in Beckley. He died in the VA hospital. When he died, he was unemployable. He was driving a cab here in town, bootlegging, trying to meet men's meet. His brother lives in near where I did, and they had an autopsy on his body. His heart was twice the size of a normal man. His liver, his kidneys, and his brain were all affected by alcohol. And all at once I knew that the book wasn't wrong. The book is right. For those of us who continue to drink, we have an incurable and fatal illness. And in the big book it says it is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And they forgot, I think, one important word, patient. Patient. Doesn't matter how long I've been sober. If I take one drink of whiskey, three shots, three fingers of bourbon, I get it all back right now. I'm not one of these people who think I have a thinking problem and not a drinking problem. I am an alcoholic. I have a physical allergy to alcohol. And if I ingest it, it's all back right now. Now, I may have a thinking problem in order to make me pick up that first drink, but what the root cause of me is a physical allergy to alcohol. And that's important for me to remember. Last thing I want to touch on is another bottom I had not too long ago, several years ago. I've experienced depression. I've been sober in AA 27 years. I go to AA meetings regularly. I practice the 12 steps in my life. I share with people wherever and whenever I can. Always thought that I was doing everything I needed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can be wrong, and was. This depression came on me rather suddenly, and I had no understanding of what it was. And it was, again, it's emotional pain. It's not physical pain, it's emotional pain. I went to aside from this, I heard a lady talk. It was at the Senecal Retreat House in Charleston, a nun there that gave a workshop on depression. She said, what depression is what psychiatrists call the common cold of the mind. Every one of us experience it to some degree, lesser, greater or less, and repeatedly over the periods of our life. Nobody escapes it. And many times it's triggered by some particular event that brings back a memory, whatever that kind of memory may be, that all at once it starts producing negative thoughts. And you feed on those. You get a feeling of self-worth. Nothing's right. Nothing's good. Everything's bad. And it's completely negative. And your mind, it gets caught up with that over and over and over again. And any of you who've experienced it know what it is. And I've heard people talk about it, and I kind of, be one of those guys, cheer up and it'll be all right. It's not that way. People, just to tell somebody cheer up isn't going to help. But the pain got bad. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think most people will tell you, most alcoholics don't do anything until it gets painful. And the pain got bad. And I became fearful. I knew that if I couldn't get rid of this pain, I might drink. In fact, it was more than might. I thought that if I don't get rid of this pain, I'm going to drink. And I don't want to. So what I did is I followed the instructions. I did what people told me. I revisited all of the 12 steps in the next 2 weeks. And I took the fourth and fifth step over again. I want to talk a minute about the fourth and fifth step in my life, and as I perceived it. The first time I ever probably even ventured and even think of it as a step, but I think it might have been at that time, was the first time I was asked to leave. We were new in the program, 6 months sober, 9 months, I don't know, a year sober. And somebody says, "Will you lead?" And I agreed. I was scared of that. And I had to take for a moment and think, what was my life like, what happened, and what was it like now? All my weeks and months in AA, I never done that. I never had a story. I was just coming to meetings saying, "My name's Bob and I'm an alcoholic, trying to stay sober." And I tried to put the events in my life, and I thought, yeah, there is something here. There is a story. Then later on, like most of us, I think many people approach the steps, and this fourth step and fifth step in particular, they don't want to do it, and then something inside them says, I got to, and it won't leave you alone until you do. So I did that. I took a fourth step. I took it honestly, as capable as being, and I took it with a clergyman. And it did help me, did relieve me. I never took that step over again in that way. I thought I was fulfilling that step when I would share with one of you intimately. I thought I would be sharing in event doing that step when I might even be in leading like this, because I'm reliving my life and maybe my character defects or what have you. And I thought I was maintaining whatever that step meant over these years because of these actions. But this time I sat and I took the step over again, and I did it after being sober a long time, and I took it quite differently. And I saw that there were character defects in there that I had never surfaced. And they were what was causing me my depression. And because of that, I was able to go and take that fifth step, and I doubled up the meetings I was going to, and it's gone away, and it's never come back. And the point and thing I want to share with you in that event is that everything that we need is in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. 1971, I think it was, we had the Southeastern in conference in Charleston, and Nell Wing's secretary was there, or Nell Wing was there, who was the secretary of Bill Wilson. She's a non-alcoholic. I asked Mel if there was anything Bill was working on before he died, any new writings, anything he was doing. And she said he was doing some things but he was writing on, but nothing had anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my perception that God would not have taken Bill or Dr. Bob if their mission were not completed. We have the 12 steps, we have the 12 traditions, we have the 12 concepts, we have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have all the tools that we need to survive as alcoholics. And that because of this, I think that there isn't anything else that we need to look for. There's nothing I know in my own life, there's nothing I need to look for outside this program in order for my well-being as an alcoholic. When anyone comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a change in their life. There's no one who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, even if they go away again, that are not remember what that meeting was like and has not been touched by this program. And I think that probably the thing that I would like to sum up right now is that the words that I began with is that because of this program, and because of people like you sharing your experience with me, I too can say, I'm one of them. Thank you.